Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hey people, this is Ben, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. I know you already know that. I hope you're all good. Thank you very much for joining me for episode 74, which features photographer and independent photo book publisher extraordinaire, Aina Dufresne. A bit of business before I introduce Aina properly. Tote bags. I have a very limited number of rather awesome small voice tote bags available for sale, featuring the podcast logo and the Eugene Smith quote that inspired its title. You can own one by going to bensmithphoto.com/merch and ordering it there. A bargain at £6 each, I've got to say, plus postage, shipping worldwide while stocks last. I only got 50 done, so in all seriousness, I don't think that's going to be for much longer. So go order your tote bag today. As always, you can support the ongoing production of the podcast with a small recurring monthly donation on the website. You can leave a review on iTunes. And if you need a new website, I can sort that out for you using Squarespace, which one of these days will officially sponsor this podcast, given all the free publicity I already give them. So Aina Dufresne is an Irish photographer now based in Berlin, Germany, and formerly in London. And Taipei in Taiwan and Osaka in Japan. His work focuses on our urban experiences. Aina attended Goldsmiths College, London, and received an MA in Photography and Urban Cultures. In 2011, he founded The Velvet Cell, an independent photo book publisher with specific focus on projects that explore urbanism, architecture, and our modern way of living in cities. To date, The Velvet Cell has published over 60 books by both up-and-coming photographers and seasoned experts. Aina works closely with each artist, usually designing the books himself. In 2017, Aina wrote and published for free the Indie Photo Book Publishing Guide, aimed at teaching others all he's learnt in his years of book publishing. There's a link to that guide in the show notes on the website, and a brilliant free resource it is too, as is this interview with Aina Dufresne.
I think you talk about this a lot, like the industry as a whole is really going through changes, and I think people are really trying to figure out how it works now. How they fit into it.
Definitely.
Like, I definitely feel like I came to this whole thing about 20, 30 years too late, you know?
Really?
Well, in terms of, like, I never felt like photography would be, like, project-based photography would be very viable, like, as a job. I know a lot of people do it, and that's amazing, but, you know, compared to, like, people I know now who, probably maybe yourself, like, used to shoot for magazines and editorial work, that was an avenue that, as far as I can see, it doesn't really exist. Or if it does, there's a lot more photographers out there than jobs.
Definitely. Oh, yeah. No question. No question.
It's like more time now maybe for kind of personal projects.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, this is my point. It was like, well, I said this to someone yesterday. You know, if you're not earning any money doing the stuff you don't particularly want to do, then you might as well not earn any money doing the stuff you do want to do.
Yeah, that Jim Carrey quote as well, where he says, you can fail at anything, you might as well fail at something you like doing.
Right, exactly. Yeah, similar thing.
Well, I think the economy as a whole is just changing totally. You know, it's, yeah, I suppose it's kind of, maybe in some ways, it's kind of, this is a great time to kind of follow your passion.
Totally. Yeah, I think so. And there are, obviously, you know, it's becoming a bit of a cliche. And I'm aware of myself saying the same things over and over again, which must be quite annoying for my regular listeners. Sorry, regular listeners. Now I can't even remember what I was going to say. Yeah, you know, there are opportunities that there didn't used to be. And so there is a bit of kind of, you know, on the one hand you lose, on the one hand you gain kind of stuff. But the reason I wanted to get you on, well, one of the reasons I wanted to get you on is because you're a guy who wears two hats, like a lot of people do these days. Because obviously you're a photographer, you have to be in order to qualify for this dubious honour of appearing on the podcast. But you also became a sort of accidental publisher of photo books. And I really want to sort of pick your brains, as you know, in that capacity, because I'm sure you've learnt a huge amount from doing it. So you run The Velvet Cell, which is your own kind of one-man publishing operation.
Yeah, basically.
So
I think, you know, kind of the point you're making there, my own photography and this, I was kind of thinking back on it a while ago, and I kind of came to the realization that maybe the publishing is in this weird way a huge procrastination about my own work.
You know? Right, yeah.
Or that I couldn't create the work that I wanted to, so instead I went out to look for it.
Right. Is that what you feel?
Well, I know it definitely kind of came about, like, I never had the idea of publishing ever. And it just kind of came from looking for work that I felt I connected with. And I just really couldn't find enough. And I kind of, like, I didn't grow up with photography. I didn't, it wasn't a thing in my life at all until I moved to London. Mm. Or just before.
And you were how old?
So I was 21.
Right.
It just wasn't a thing at all. And suddenly, kind of when I came to London, I was unemployed. As I said to you before, it was a crash. I used to kind of go to bed late. I wake up about like 2 p.m. It was
so this
winter.
Is like 2009.
Yeah, yeah. And I used the camera as a kind of a way to explore the city.
Hmm.
I'd go around Stratford and these areas. And London was just so different to me from Dublin. And I just fell in love with photography. I just thought it was the most amazing thing. And I got so ahead of myself that I had a show in some bar in Shoreditch. And of course I sold nothing, you know, and then I had another little show somewhere else. And of course sold nothing. And I think my dad bought one actually.
but that's still quite, you know, to be having shows at that stage when you've only just really started doing it is quite encouraging in a way.
Yes.
Enough to make you think that there's something worth pursuing there.
Yeah, I think I was a victim of my own expectations, you know, kind of. And I think looking back on the publishing even, I'm kind of a victim of my own expectations. Kind of you want it, you're not prepared maybe to have the patience. You don't understand why you're not successful now, which is, I think, is another reason why your podcasts are so interesting, because you kind of go, wow. Like the story of like Mark Power, for example, like the Berlin, going to Berlin, it's just really illuminating.
Mm.
So,
well, there's always an element of dumb luck, you know, in people's careers. I think that's one of the things to take from that particular story. And of course, you make your own luck to a large extent. So, what brought you to London? Because you grew up just outside Dublin,
satellite town.
Yeah. So, what was your upbringing like?
Comfortable. We, you know, lived in suburbia, semi-detached home. It was, I was always a bit on the outside. I went to an Irish school growing up.
Mm.
And most of the people almost everyone I lived with in this town went to the local English school. So,
oh, really?
So from the beginning, I was always the kind of odd one out. And
What were the differences then? Were they teaching you Gaelic and stuff?
Everything was through Gaelic.
Holy
or Irish.
Shit.
Yeah.
Right.
Everything. Like, so, and I look back at it now and, you know, people used to kind of make fun of it, like, oh, he goes to the Irish school.
Mm.
And now I think about that and I think, isn't that so messed up? Like, it's our language, but we were so alienated from it that we kind of made fun of people who spoke it. It was pretty comfortable. I studied, I went to university, I studied history and sociology. I had no plans ever to come to London. It's just kind of the crash that made that happen.
Right, because the Irish economy was so badly affected.
Yeah, it's just, I had a job for a few months at the end of 2008, and my brother was already living here. And I came over to visit him, and after a few days, I just realized there was no point going home. So I just stayed.
So what was it that made you want to kind of pick up a camera at that stage?
I kind of had that feeling a few months before. This is such a weird thing. Like I was on holidays with my mom's 50th, I think. Yeah. And we were in Italy and I was kind of, you know, I was taking photos and I just couldn't get the photos that I wanted. Like I was just with a point and shoot kind of digital camera. I really, as I said, like had never grown up with cameras. I didn't have that kind of experience. And I got so frustrated. I could see things. I felt like I could see things with my eye, but I couldn't get it on the camera. I couldn't get it, couldn't convert it. So I asked for an SLR for Christmas and that's just kind of, I just kind of, when I came to London and I just kind of, I felt so a bit alienated by London. There was, at one point, there were so many people, but I knew nobody, you know? And I kind of felt like the camera was a good way to
go out, and especially East London, there's like so much like old industry, and I didn't have that growing up. Like I just, you know, I grew up in a one street town, kind of like there's one main street and there's just houses everywhere. So it was very interesting for me just to kind of use it as a way of understanding my new surroundings.
The Velvet Cell has a very particular kind of niche really, and it's very much related to that because it's about the built environment. It's mm-hmm. about cities really. So mm-hmm. I guess in a way your kind of experiences of London, you know, it's been a continuation in a way of that of mm-hmm. that theme. Because what were you shooting? Just, you're not really a people photographer, no. are you? You no. shoot you shoot spaces and places. Is that that's always been the way?
Yeah, I've always been really interested not in the individual but in the world that we're living in a sense, like the structure. And I think a lot of this comes from having a degree in sociology, like the trying to understand the space and how it shapes us. And I think that's like really kind of valid, kind of interesting kind of question about like the world that we live in. And especially in relation to cities, like I kind of said earlier on about feeling like didn't know anybody in London. I always have this question in my head, like, cities are a mark of progress, but are they natural? Like, you know, do they alienate us? You know, it's just interesting for me.
I've never are we really supposed to be living like this?
Yeah, yeah. Like,
and if not,
you know, what does it do to the human? And kind of, so I kind of thought of it as a way of exploring that, like that question. And yeah, not so much of a people photographer, that's for sure.
Mm.
Yeah. I want the viewer to kind of be able to imagine, like, you know, I don't want the people who are in the photos would be the objects as opposed to the subject.
Right. Yeah, totally. Well, you've traveled around a lot. I mean, you've lived in Japan, you've lived in Taiwan. How did that all come about? What happened after London?
After 3 years in London, I went to study in Goldsmiths. I did the photography and urban cultures masters, and I met a girl, and she said, you know, why don't you want to try Taiwan, you know, see what it's like. So she kind of had a year on her student visa, and I was interested to see what the world outside Europe was like. So I said, okay, we'll go, we'll see what it's like.
So you went to...
I went to Taipei first.
To stay for how long, in theory?
Well, the original plan was just for a year, but we ended up in 2 years, and she always wanted to move to Japan, so we said, okay, let's try it.
Great. So then you went to Japan?
Yeah.
Right. So, and obviously this gave you an opportunity to explore the, you know, these kind of very alien cities or these built environments that you hadn't experienced before.
And so different from European cities. Yeah. I mean, they were so interesting, and I got the chance to kind of go places that, you know, for me, when I was growing up, were just like places on an atlas or places on a map, you know, like Hong Kong, Vietnam. I mean, I know now we can kind of like go to those places so much easier, but I remember just as a kid kind of just thinking like, will I ever like see Japan? Like,
you know,
like it just seems so amazing for me.
Yeah, but you did that. I mean, you were still reasonably young at that point, and I guess that must have been quite an interesting experience. Did you learn the language?
Yeah, I can speak some Chinese because my wife's Taiwanese, but Japanese, I didn't really get it.
All right, okay. I imagine it's pretty difficult.
I didn't really kind of blend with Japanese culture, to be honest.
Really?
I felt much more related to Taiwanese culture.
Mm. So her roots are there.
Yeah, she's Taiwanese.
That was why she wanted to try it, presumably.
I don't think so, to be honest. She's not, well, I better be careful about this. She likes Taiwan, but I think she was kind of more interested in me having a less Eurocentric kind of view of the world.
Right.
She just thought it'd be interesting for me. And I wouldn't have had the bravery, I think, to do it without that push.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad I did it. It's probably the best thing I've ever done.
So you were kind of, I guess, wandering around doing your thing. When did the idea of doing the publishing come up then? Did that come up?
That was in London.
That was before?
That was before I moved, yeah.
Okay.
I had the idea, you know, I've always loved books and I love photography and I love design. And I just kind of put the ideas together, and I remember having the idea one day, like, yeah, maybe I'll go work in a publishing house. Like, that could be my dream. And I thought, like, okay, you know, I can work my way up the ladder. But and you know what London's like. It's just so, I couldn't afford to never work a week. You know, I couldn't pay my rent. The idea of doing an internship, which was the norm, it just was never an option for me.
Yeah, so you already weren't thinking about earning money out of photography. You thought maybe you'd get a job and keep doing the photography.
Oh, that was very on much the side. I mean, yeah. I mean, in London, I couldn't afford a week without working. You know, if I bought a pair of shoes, it was like, okay, next week I need to really save. So I kind of had the idea of, yeah, of working for a publishing house. That's what like kind of my dream was. And then I discovered some smaller publishers who I'd never heard of before, who were kind of doing their own thing, just making small books and financing it themselves. And this really blew my mind. I had no idea about printing at this point or anything. And I don't know if you've ever heard of these publishers, the small Americans one, like Hasla or Seams. And then there's a, you know, the Swiss one called Neves. Have you ever heard of them? They're kind of very small, kind of do very intimate publications, and it's not kind of like a Taschen, you know, it's like the anti-Taschen in a sense. And I got really inspired by this. I was like, you know, what if I can create a platform for work that I find really, you know, powerful? Because I just couldn't find that work. I'd be in bookshops and I'd be looking through all the books and I just couldn't resonate with
it. You were looking for photography that was about the sort of thing that you were interested in shooting yourself. Wanted to see some examples of someone who's just already doing that, but you didn't really find.
I suppose I was looking for inspiration. Yeah. I mean, one of the photographers that I did find was Peter Bielobrzeski, who I did publish then and I still publish now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I remember his work, kind of finding his books and it really speaking to me. And I just kind of, it encapsulated the philosophy of what I wanted to create a platform for.
Yeah, and now he's a friend of yours, so...
Yeah, that's great.
It's weird how things sometimes work out.
Yeah, it's a dream to publish his work.
Yeah. But, you know, like, so photo book publishing is already a very niche thing, as we know. Mm-hmm. Did you not think that if you then made it even more niche by having a very kind of specific remit as to what The Velvet Cell was about, did you not think that that would just be kind of almost a way of, you know, limiting the potential to such a point that it wasn't going to be possible? Or did you always want to just make it really very specific?
Yeah, I never thought of it. Like, it never started as a economic kind of idea. I mean, it was purely a passion.
Yeah.
And
but you've still got to make it pay for itself somehow. You don't want to be losing money. No. Right.
See, that's the thing now. When I was in Asia, I never had to worry about that because living in Asia, I needed a visa. To get a visa, I need a job. So this is the first year I've actually taken money out of the books for me, you know, to live on. Like up until earlier, mid-2017, it was just, I invested in this first book. It cost £55. And the sales of that just went into the next one.
£55 total.
Yeah, that's my total investment in it's been 62 books now.
You've done 62? Mm-hmm. Wow, man.
And it's always just, so I just really let it sit there, kind of keep going around, and I didn't kind of worry. I mean, I didn't have that luxury in Asia. I had to work, I had to have a job for the visa. So I just, like, that was its own pot. It kind of sales, and I got the money from the sales and I put it into another book, and I didn't mix with my living expenses. And I think it was a good way. It let me kind of do, I always kind of thought of it as a negative, like I wasn't a real publisher in a sense. But I was having a conversation with one of the photographers last year, and I kind of realized how it kind of lets me do the projects I really want to do instead of ones that I think, oh, okay, that's, you know, commercially viable, but it doesn't resonate with me, but I'll get money from it. I've never done anything like that. It's
right,
all
right.
Been, I want to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because you've got a number of sort of principles by which you, you know, by which you kind of, I don't know.
Select the work.
Yeah, and I want to, we'll get onto that, I think, in a minute. But I'm wondering how you kind of learned the ropes, because there's a lot to learn. And, you know, you were very much kind of, doing it on your own. So what was that process like?
Very slow.
There any disasters at the beginning?
Not just the beginning. I mean, I remember one of the first couple of books I did, the zines, they were all kind of digital. I remember, like, I still, even on the sixth book, I couldn't quite understand how the PDF was going to become a, you know, the only printing I had experience of was my inkjet at home, you know.
Right, right.
And I remember, for example, the first offset book we did. So offset would be like the, you know, the big kind of mainstream printing houses. And I remember we put a lot of money, or I actually did invest some money into this one, yeah. And I remember we chose the paper, and we chose the paper based on, or I chose the paper based on the feel of the paper, not really understanding how it relates or how the ink will sit on the paper. And that was quite a disaster.
Right, okay.
That was very disappointing.
So it was sort of a bit of trial and error, really, and you just, learn.
That was so disappointing. That was like months of work. And then, you know, it really teaches you, though. You know, you can't... Everything is give and take. You know, you might have nice paper, but you have to understand how the ink goes on the paper, you know? And then if you really want good reproduction, you kind of have to sacrifice maybe the tactileness of the paper.
Interesting, yeah.
Other disasters, too, yeah.
Yeah. But also you design these books as well yourself, mm-hmm. and you're not a designer by training. So how do you go about learning to do that?
Well, for the first year, when I had the idea, for the first year, I did like an online magazine. It was like a PDF. I did that for a first year. And that was kind of for me to kind of understand what InDesign was, for example. And I would make terrible mistakes. I would draw the boxes and I would fit the image into it. And then the photographer would tell me, like, I'm really happy you featured my work, but why is my image like this? And I was like, oh, God.
Oh, God, yeah.
So just trial and error. Just, you know, slowly, one at a time. I still, to be honest, every time I do a book, I still think, God, this is going to be something I've completely messed up or missed. Or I never quite feel like I've understood the whole process. And I think that kind of comes from never having worked in publishing.
Mm.
And it's not that easy to find resources about how to do these things. If you look up about printing, it's never about photograph and printing. You know, there's a special relationship there in terms of reproduction. It's different from a normal paperback book.
But also, you're talking about a whole bunch of very distinct skills, and no one, you know, would expect to be able to do all of those things. So it's in a way you've kind of taking on quite a lot for yourself there. I mean, you know, designing is a very specific thing, and knowing about printing is a very specific thing. And obviously, there are people in the photo book publishing world who have, you know, definitely know a lot about this stuff. Have been doing it for years and years. I guess you become one of them. The economics of photo books, I'd really want to ask you about, because I think it's mm-hmm. something that, you know, you've got a lot of experience in now. So what's the economics of printing in terms of how much it costs and how many to do? Because people seem to, like, 500 seems to be a very kind of standard number. So is it the case that if you print less than that, it doesn't necessarily cost you any less?
Yeah, this is interesting. Yeah, I think kind of 500 is usually pitched as a, like, exclusive 500, but really it's like that's the minimum we could print,
right? Yeah. We have no idea if we're going to sell them all, but
this is the minimum our printer will let us like go through,
right?
In Taiwan, which is where I print, because I have relations there with printers, we could print 300, but generally speaking 500 is the kind of minimum you do. Is that your question?
Yeah, well, yeah, because I wanted to know if it was if you could print fewer and therefore make things cheaper. But it's a question of the economics of printing. And,
yeah,
you know,
the main costs, as far as I can see, are in the setting up of the machine and the plates. And those costs do not change whether you're printing 10 copies or 500 copies.
Right.
And I think, you know, I've seen, like, for example, Nasraeli Press in California, like, they will do limited editions of 100 books, you know, so it is done. But those unit prices go up.
Yeah.
So you have to sell then at a higher price.
Right, right, right. Yeah, and it's also worth mentioning that obviously, you know, we all know that there are lots of, you know, well-known successful photographers who sell, you know, many, many thousands. But we're here more concerned about people who, you know, might want to make a book for the first time and are going, how the hell am I going to sell 500 of the bloody things? So What's the arrangement you have with your photographers? Like, so you as you said, haven't really taken any money out of the, we'll call it the business.
Well, I have started
until
now.
Until recently. Until then, you were best basically just kind of breaking even. And were your photographers, were they earning anything out of the process, or were they just happy to have a book out there in the world that hadn't cost them any money to do?
It's changed a lot. In the first couple of years, it was, it was all me. I like this project. This is how I want to do it. The photographer agrees. I pay for everything. I give the photographer books. And that was kind of the situation for the first maybe 3 years, I think, 4 years. And then it kind of changed a little bit. And now it's kind of a mixture of both. So, for example, sometimes, we'll try to find a third party kind of contribution, or even if the photographer has to kind of pay in, then we kind of figure out a deal between us, like maybe in terms of like books or royalties, that we try and, I'm always very conscious of trying to make it an agreement between both of us. I do not want to ever have a situation where one person feels like taken advantage of, and that can work both ways, really. And I think it's a very fair thing. And I would, some of the books that I do, for example, if they are with someone who kind of has more of a reputation, has done a lot of books before, I'm kind of okay to take that chance in financially speaking. But I had a realization maybe a year or two ago when I was looking at my kind of sales figures, and really 90% of my sales were for a couple of photographers, the ones who you might kind of know better. And even though I think the profile of the publishing house was rising all the time, as I kind of published people who were known, like it was still hard to introduce new people into that, and harder than I thought. And I find that a bit like disheartening, because I love the, for me, I've always wanted to be photography first, not photographer first. Do you know what I mean?
But then there's a kind of pragmatism that has to come into it, which is that you've got to think that you're going to sell them. How do you know, or how do you make a kind of calculated guess as to what's going to be popular or what's going to sell?
Well, the word there is guess. You can, I do make guesses. How do I do it?
What are the criteria? Or is it just an instinctive thing more?
I mean, I have definitely chosen projects before where I just really like them so much, and it's been based on that. But I also would spend time to look into, like, how active is the photographer in terms of promoting himself? And just, is there a difference between a photographer who maybe kind of has a project and is also quite active in terms of getting, already kind of getting exposure for that, and somebody who kind of just has some nice photos on a website that no one's ever seen, or even if they're on a website, like, because you really need the team effort. You're trying to tap in a way to their audience, and you're also trying to get them to become aware of what I'm doing. So it's still very much a guess, and I've definitely guessed wrong a lot of the time.
Right. Okay. What have been the biggest successes?
The biggest successes have been the books with Peter Bielorusky, Alexander Gronsky. I recently did a book with Alejandro Cartagena and Toshio Shibata from Japan. And they're not, that's not a surprise, you know what I mean? So I think they're trusted names.
Yeah, they're people that already have got a profile.
Yeah, they've got books behind them. And I think, the kind of first big name maybe I published was Gronsky, and that was in 2015. So up until then, I was always doing kind of smaller projects, books that are projects that I really, really liked, and just taking a chance on them. And it worked. And one kind of strange anomaly I've noticed is that as I've started to release more people with a profile, as I kind of mentioned before, it's actually much, much harder to sell the smaller books and newer books than I thought it would be. It's kind of like they kind of dipped down as the other ones kind of went up.
Right. Interesting. Have you been taken by surprise on anything which, was kind of more popular than you anticipated? Or even the inverse, where you thought something might do well and just bombed?
Not massively, to be honest. And I think I would owe that to the fact that I've kind of been building a steady audience over the years with kind of consistent work. So I kind of think that, I like to think that I've been making very specific work for a specific audience and that they kind of trust me at this point. So none of them are really kind of nosedives, you know. That's what I kind of hope, or that's what I attribute that to. Nothing has kind of totally bombed. For sure, a lot of books could have done a lot better. But nothing terrible, thankfully, so far. I've had some really nice surprises. For example, one of the books I did with a Canadian photographer, Kyler Zeleny.
Yeah.
That was kind of a... It's a small book, but it was a big book for me at the time. And
it's one of these... I like these little... books that you can hold in one hand.
I really like that too. Yeah. I always want them to be kind of intimate. You're welcome to open that.
I'll have a look at that one later.
He was like, I mean, he had never kind of, he didn't have much of a profile, let's say.
Yeah.
And I really liked this project. It kind of looked at depopulation in Canada. It combined essays. It was kind of a research project in a sense. And that did really well, which was really good to see, because you kind of like, you feel like, great, like people are responding to the work, not just a name.
Mm-hmm.
This is, I find, really, really rewarding.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, with this project I did here, which this book for me is called Crossing Over by Yanina Shevchenko. And
it's like a little pamphlet almost.
Mm-hmm. This was a kind of a make or break book for me. This kind of came after that disaster I told you about with the paper. And okay, actually, you know what, that would be a good, that nosedived. Mm-hmm. I worked on that for months. I thought that would do so well. I thought I was like, I'm getting there, you know, and it just really nosedived. And I kind of, you know, considered, I was very close to giving up at that point.
Well, why didn't you then? How do you kind of process those events?
I take time. I always go in ups and downs, to be honest. I find that maybe I kind of start to take it too seriously, or I'm trying to force it too much. And then I kind of go away and I remember I'm doing this because it's fun and I love it. And, you know, when I find, like, there's been quite a few times where I've been, you know, okay, I'm really tired, I'm really burnt out now. And then I'll come across a project and I'm like, okay, one more. We'll just do this one, you know?
So you become kind of energized again by
the work.
Yeah, the work. But also it's nice to see that, or to be reminded that, you know, there are lots of ways of doing things. And like this one that I'm looking at now, Crossing Over, by Yanina
Shevchenko.
Shevchenko, thank you for the pronunciation. There's only what, 10, 15, 12 pictures in there, something like that. And, you know, yeah, it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, I like that. I love that idea of a small,
you know, you've
project.
Got different options.
Yeah. And there's an essay in the back of it as well.
Yeah. So maybe you should explain a little bit about the built environment and what that actually means, and you know, what are the, you know, kind of, if someone wanted to pitch a project to you,
mm-hmm.
Obviously there'd be a whole bunch of criteria you'd be looking at, but just specifically in terms of the theme that the Velvet Cell is about, can you kind of articulate that?
You would not believe the amount of times I've edited and re-edited my about page. Mm. Like I've found it very hard to kind of put these into words.
Yeah, it is quite a difficult kind of concept.
I'm interested in the way we live today, and I'm interested in photography projects that kind of shine a light on that and kind of explore that. I think there's kind of an absurdity in a way to our world, like a lot of it's what's natural anymore, and I just think, how does that change our human relations? Just, you know, when you say that, I kind of think of, I remember when I used to come out of my apartment in Osaka, and there was kind of a long road and I could see up, it was probably about a kilometer. And I remember I used to come out and just think, you know, there's nothing natural here. You know, there were maybe two or three trees, but they were planted by humans. You know what I mean? And just, it was just a concrete jungle, you know, there was nothing. And so you kind of have to realize, like, we built this world. The cities, in a sense, and what do they say about us? So that's what I find very interesting.
Mm, yeah. Well, let's take your book as a sort of example in a way, because your book's called Tales Beneath the Arches, which you shot in what, Taipei?
Yeah.
Tell us about it. I will obviously put a link on the show notes, but obviously this is published by the Velvet Cell. Yeah, how did the project kind of come about?
Well, this was kind of inspired a lot by Peter Bielorusky's work, who did a project called Neon Tigers many years ago, where he looked at certain Asian cities and the kind of did a vision, the almost kind of Blade Runner-esque nature of it, where you have these kind of highways going through and you have the kind of wealthy living at the top and then the kind of chicken sellers, as you say, living at the bottom. And I kind of really, this is a kind of similar situation in Taipei. And I really wanted to kind of explore the dynamics of urban planning on people on the ground, literally. Like, how are their lives affected? Because, and also how does urban planning change the way people live their lives, in a sense? Because if you think about it, these are all kind of imposed from above. Like a government or power decides that we need to connect that place with this place. So you have these huge highways running through the city. And for me, this was such a contrast with, Dublin and London. We don't have these kind of massive expressways running through.
No.
And if we do, I've done some projects here kind of on the M25.
Mm.
Yeah. And always these spaces underneath are dead. There are no-go spaces. Where in a city like Taipei, which is just so dense, you can't afford to have these spaces that are empty. So it was really interesting to me to see how they utilize these spaces and repurpose them in ways that, we would never go near them.
Right, right.
There were markets, there were dance schools, there were recycling centers.
The closest thing we have here would be the railway arches, which very often used as kind of it creates a kind of space where you can put a little business in there, or whatever. But it's nothing like this. So is this something that you kind of struck you as soon as you went there?
No, absolutely not. Peter came over to print the first book we did together, and that was maybe in the second year I was there, and I hadn't really shot anything, to be honest, in the 18 months that I had been there, because I just think when you go somewhere so different and so new, it's just so easy to fall into cliches.
Yeah.
I would have just photographing temples and things like that. So I really wanted to bide my time to find something that I was interested in, and it was just through conversations with Peter that it kind of struck me, and I knew I had maybe 4 months or 5 months left in the country, and it's a really good kind of motivating thing, and I was kind of doing it every day, and it was such a, I don't think I've had a project like that since, where I knew really what I wanted to show and what I wanted to capture, and I was,
yeah, you had a really clear kind of idea in your mind. Mm. Also, you knew the place by then.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah.
What are you shooting this with, just out of interest?
That I shot with a Mark II, mm-hmm. 5D.
Oh, okay, so it's digital.
That is digital, yeah. I had been shooting film up until then, and I just found that the learning process was just too slow for me. I was always kind of shooting, and then I wouldn't develop it for a month, and then by the time I got it, I was like, okay, there's something wrong here. Is it the camera? Is it the lens? Is it the development? Is it the scanning? And I just said, and I, when Peter came over, he was shooting digital, and I just kind of got the, I just said, okay, look, I'll just go for it, see what I can do. Put the image first, not the process.
Right, right, right. But so how does publishing other people's work feed into or influence your own, as it were, in terms of, I guess, what you're learning from editing and sequencing and that kind of thing and the actual production of the book?
Yeah, massively. I mean, I think I'm super inspired by all the people I publish. Like, they all their work kind of feeds into what I end up creating. But I think publishing this book was one of the hardest things I ever did. It's so hard to do your own project. Like, I find it so easy. I come to other people's projects with such clarity.
Right, right. Yeah, it's easier to judge or to assess other people's work in an objective manner because you're kind of removed from it. Whereas with your own stuff, yeah. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, you're kind of only seeing a selection of what someone else does. You don't know everything that went into it. You don't know, you're kind of working on the basis of like what they've told you and a certain amount of photos. Whereas when it's your own, I just found I was procrastinating all the time and I couldn't kind of come to an edit and I would talk to people and then it just wouldn't feel right and I would change it again. But I mean, thankfully I had the knowledge in terms of the technical knowledge of the books I had done before, where that part wasn't such a difficulty. like with all the books, I kind of just let the, like, when it comes to the design, I just kind of, I know when it's what I want to do. Like, I don't do anything, and then I just think about it a lot, and then I kind of see it, and that's it. And like, you could have a designer come in at that point, and it wouldn't change my mind. They'd be like, no, I want it like this.
Right.
Because your design kind of approach, in a way, is just keep it simple, right?
Yeah, someone said to me one time a very nice quote, which was beautiful restraint.
Right.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like the photography to do the talking, keep it simple. Yeah, that's my favorite. That's the way I try to do it.
So I was just going to look at the values that you've sort of, your kind of, stated values for the Velvet Cell. Focus on the mission.
Well, that would be kind of, in relation to the kind of projects that I publish. So as I said, like, I want it to be photography first.
Mm.
I'm not interested in publishing a lot of big names and unrelated projects. You know, for me, it has to be like, this is what it's about, and this is what I exist to serve, in a sense.
Yeah. Quality before stature. So that's about, the images rather than the person who's taking them, how famous they are or whatever. Yeah.
I have to love the project. It doesn't matter to me if the person is really well known and I think that I can sell 1,000 copies. It's the integrity of the publishing house as a whole.
Images belong in print. So that's obviously, that kind of speaks for itself. You believe in photo books as the kind of right medium for photography.
Yeah. I feel like it's the best form for them. I don't necessarily, exhibitions are in print too, but it's not a format that I particularly enjoy. I like having the time. Like, I find myself at exhibitions surrounded by pictures, and I'm just in the, at the table looking at the book, the same pictures in the book. It's just more comfortable. It's kind of, you can create your own scenario. And images on a screen, there's just something missing.
Mm.
You never feel like you're really seeing the image. I feel like it's like when it's on a page, something about maybe the light or just the tactileness of it. Like, okay, now I can see it. That's what I feel, really.
Yeah. Keep it simple. I think we've kind of covered that. Keep it fresh. What's that about? That's a nice...
Did I write that?
Yeah. We could gloss over it, though.
Well, okay. Well, I think what I mean in that sense is that it is very easy for me to repeat myself. And that's something I have to kind of be aware of. As you said, it is niche. And I have to make sure... I have to try my best to make sure I'm not just kind of doing the same project, but in a different place.
Yeah.
That is something I struggle with, yeah.
Mm. Organic growth.
Just letting it kind of... I like the idea of it growing in response to demand.
Yeah.
Rather than going out and taking huge loans.
Yeah.
I've never been that kind of person.
Yeah, it's not like, it was never a business thing, right? It's not like you're trying to...
It became
build
one.
Right. But you're not driven by that motivation.
I don't think anybody who was business driven would
do this. It would be mental. Yeah, you wouldn't get very far on Dragon's Den if you had a photo book publishing idea.
It wouldn't work so well.
Transparency. So,
trying to be honest about how it works and kind of clear, and trying to create fair deals between people. Like, and I think. I think photographers really have to think about what they want from publishing. I always ask this. It's so easy to say, I want a book. But there's a lot of work involved. And there has to be something. They have to kind of understand, I think, why they want it. Either it's a means to an end, or it's an end in itself. So I like the idea of kind of just, being honest, being transparent about how it works, why the person wants it, and what we can do with it, in a sense. Mm.
I mean, you're quite a supporter of the idea of self-publishing, despite the fact that you're a publisher yourself. So, how do you feel about the sort of self-publishing kind of and the popularity of that
method? I think it's great. I really can't think of a negative thing about it. I mean, we have this conversation always. There's too many books, and I just feel like. That's who does that serve? It's kind of, it feels like the people who have the books are kind of saying there's too many books now, and it's really kind of stopping creativity. it's I think it's making people kind of worry, and who people might go on to make books, and they might be terrible or they might be great, but it's kind of stopping them before they even get to that point. And we, you know, if you look at other forms of art, written word, music, there's a lot of terrible stuff out there, you know?
Yeah.
But you need to have that to kind of have the balance, and you need to give people that chance to kind of go and discover. And maybe the first book will be terrible, but they'll grow through that. And I think that, like, you know, I get a lot of submissions, and because my edit is so narrow, I often just have to kind of say, look, it's a great project, but it just doesn't fit what I'm doing. But, like, go and do it yourself. Like, it's doable. And I've seen a lot of people do it. A lot of people you've interviewed have had great success with self-publishing.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, yeah, just because, you know, it's not for you doesn't mean to necessarily say it's a bad project or that the photography is bad. Mm. What kind of, when people submit stuff to you, do you see certain mistakes being repeated in terms of the way that they're showing you the stuff, or just in terms of the quality of the images?
Well, the quality of the images, I suppose, depends on the project. But I would definitely say that there's a real lack of care in submissions. You know, it's really like, it really comes across if someone just kind of sends you an email with some images attached. Like, it just doesn't speak that, like, they, or, you know, dear sir, madame.
Oh, geez, but that's like 101, isn't it? I can't believe we're still talking about that stuff. You know, what? Surely, you know.
And I feel like if you, like,
people aren't still falling into that trap.
One of the projects that I published last year, it was a physical submission, you know, and I got these, and it was beautiful presentation, and I had a photo, and it really grabbed my attention. You know, there is something to be said for that. Do not just send an email.
So, like, it's, you can, terrible. Yeah. So it's someone's just kind of done a kind of mail out to, you
mass
know,
mail,
to random book publishers.
There's no respect, even there's no self respect in that.
No, you're screwed from the start.
And I don't know what kind of publisher will say yes. Like, yeah. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. It's like approaching, you know, I don't know, agents or anyone really. You know, you've got to
honestly, I think the advice would be, like, do your research. You don't have to submit to everyone, submit to 5, but do it well. Do something that makes them kind of we get too many emails already, you know. Do something that makes it kind of stand out in a way. And if you don't have success with that, definitely look at the self-publishing thing. I just think it's a wonderful way for people to kind of, who, you know, when I think of publishing before and all the gatekeepers that were involved, and I'm, you know, in any kind of art form, the amount of people who had great projects that were just not taken on. And who's to say that these gatekeepers know better?
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, the danger is that you still got to sell them all, even if you self-publish. And although, you know, you're obviously taking a certain number of pre-orders. I don't know. I mean, you know.
I think there's an advantage, though, to self-publishing that I don't have. For example, you can build that connection. I can't really speak for my photographer's work. I can present it, and I hope I do a good job of that. But I can't speak for them. And I think people make that connection when like, if somebody online through a blog, podcast, whatever it is, they kind of speaking about their work, the motivation behind their work. That's why Kickstarters that are successful is because people have made the connection with why the work's been done.
Mm-mm.
So I think there's a real advantage there. Publishing, going with a publisher in a way is kind of just, you're hoping that they'll sort all the stuff out for you. But there's things that are not their strengths. You know, I can kind of hope that the work fits into a really tight edit and that it appeals to my audience because they've already kind of liked the other work that I've done. But there's something really strong, I think, to be said for self-publishers kind of creating that relationship themselves. Mm. I've seen many people do it really, really well.
Yeah. What about an example?
Can't think of a name.
Okay.
But there's one guy I wrote his in the guide that I wrote, I featured his work, and he kind of had a blog, and he was just writing about doing the project as a whole, and then it kind of came to doing the book, and then, you know, then he kind of came to the point where he was accepting pre-orders, and I think he did really, really well. And I think the lesson there is that it comes from a long-term development of a relationship rather than just kind of like, hey, I'm new, here's a book, support me. Like, you really got to think of if you're someone who's a photographer and you like the idea of publishing your own books, you got to think of it in the long-term game.
Mm.
The first book, a lot of people I think do is the first book, they invest a lot of money into it. They realize then how hard it is to sell, and they just cannot make that commitment again for another book. But if you kind of start slower, you can kind of build that audience. And I think it's a really viable thing today.
Mm. I should mention that you kind of made a brief reference to it, but you wrote a guide to independent photo book publishing, which you very kindly put out into the world for free, as you know, as people now sometimes do. But it's an incredibly useful resource. What kind of, you know, what made you want to do that apart from just altruism?
Oh, it wasn't altruism. I kind of want it for myself in a way. Like I had learned so much. Like I didn't come with this day one knowledge. Like I didn't really get my head around offset printing until maybe year three. I didn't understand that we printed from sheets probably till year two, you know what I mean? Mm. So I really kind of had this desire to kind of just put this stuff down on paper in a sense. And then I was just getting these submissions and I just felt like maybe with this information you can go and do it. It's not for me, this project, but you know, I also struggled a lot at the beginning. I couldn't find anybody to tell me, anybody to help me. I found a book by Dewey Lewis that was published in 1991. And it was a great resource, but a lot of it was so out of date by this point.
Yeah.
And I would get in touch with publishers when I was starting out. And apart from the odd one or two, nobody ever kind of would kind of give me the time to kind of explain to me how things worked. So I just thought, okay, well, I can change that in a sense. I can create something so people can understand it.
Mm. Yeah. So where can we find it? It's a PDF, isn't it? It's available.
Yeah, it's on indiephotobooks.com.
Okay.
It's a PDF, but also you can just read it online.
Right. Great. That's fantastic. Because that is really useful. There's so much good kind of hard-won kind of wisdom in there. That you had to acquire the hard way, but everyone else can just go and find.
Yeah, and I like the idea of people being a bit easier on themselves, like understanding, you know, that it doesn't work from day one. Like I remember when the first scene I did, the 55 euro one, in the first week I sold 20, and I was really, really down about that. That's good number, like, yeah, you know, but I didn't know any better. You know, I thought everyone else was selling hundreds, thousands. And so, you know, just with a bit of expectation management in a way, I feel like we're all kind of better off.
So now you've moved yourself and therefore the operation, which is a one-man operation, to Berlin. What prompted your move to Berlin?
I was very tired of... I loved Asia. It was just brilliant. But being a non-native there, you're always kind of reliant on a job to sponsor you. And I was always end up doing jobs. I was always teaching English. And I liked teaching, but I didn't like the jobs themselves. So I was just tired of always having to negotiate for another year.
Mm.
And I wanted to... And every person I was coming across in my email correspondence or everything just seemed to be in Berlin. And
it's definitely one of the places to be at the moment.
Yeah. And I, you know, I thought of coming back to London. Brexit had just happened. I just felt like Berlin was kind of a good place for people to be. Peter's in Hamburg as well, so it's kind of, it just felt like a natural choice.
So, but also, I guess it means that whatever city you move to, you can continue your sort of kind of fixation on the urban environment, and you know, you've kind of got a project one way or another ready made in a way. Although you've still got to figure out what exactly you're going to shoot. What have you been doing in Berlin? Have you got a summit you're working on?
No, I'm. It's kind of like what I said about Taipei. It takes a while, I think, to to look past the cliches, to look past the new things. And I've gotten so used to the cities in Asia that I find the cities in Europe now very hard to kind of inspire me in a way. They're so set and planned and structured, and I'm so kind of used to now the kind of chaos of cities in Taiwan or Vietnam. And I really liked that over there. There was kind of this real blurring of the lines between private and public. So in Berlin, it's very different. And I think I just need to kind of give it time to kind of find something that's interesting. Plus, it's a city that's just been photographed so much.
Mm.
It's very hard to kind of find something that is a new angle.
Yeah.
That's kind of a difficult.
So you're going to need a bit of time, and eventually you'll, you know, something will present itself in the same way that the
Arches
did in Taipei.
I know, like, quite a like Peter, for example, like he does do projects in Germany, but most of his work is kind of done in Asia, and I can kind of understand that now. I kind of feel like I'm itching to get back and to kind of explore somewhere new and to try and understand and, you know, somewhere that I can feel that I'm explaining it maybe for other people who haven't been there.
Or
kind of interpreting it in my way. Like, that's what I felt in Osaka as well, was just that, like, I was, you know, I'm very much, it's the gaze of a Westerner, you know, and kind of looking at somewhere else and kind of going, wow, that's different. And kind of, so it's all based on that kind of preconceptions. And like, how does this differ? And how is the world structured here? I remember in Osaka, like, there were all over the city, there was these huge car park elevators dotted around, like just these windowless silos. And I just thought these are the most amazing things. Like, I just couldn't imagine this in a European city, like, you know. So those are the kind of things that really kind of, the contrast between what I was used to and what was in Asia was kind of very interesting.
Mm. How's the move to Berlin going to impact the photo book pub, the printing and all that kind of stuff? Because obviously you were printing locally when mm-hmm. you were based in, mm-hmm. in Taiwan. What's going to happen then? Are you going to keep printing in Asia?
Yeah, I'm still hoping to print in Taiwan.
You just won't be there?
Yeah, I have to figure out new ways to do it. Like, I'm preparing a book at the moment and we just kind of got the proof sent over. So that's a new way of doing it for me. Mm. Usually I'm there on press. So this time it's a bit more, okay, we have the proofs and we're working. But the good thing is that I've worked with my printers. I have like maybe two. Sometimes I work with a third one. I've worked with them now for 5-6 years. So they know the kind of way I want the work.
Right,
so
right.
It's very, I trust them. And it's nice. And I think compared to what a lot of what I've heard, it's a lot more affordable.
Yeah.
And I think it kind of makes it viable for me, really.
Could this ever be a proper, the Velvet Cell, could that ever be a proper income stream? Because what, you know, what's your kind of income pie chart? Like,
yeah. It's amazing. I haven't had a stable paycheck since March. And I really thought that, you know, I would survive a month or two. And I've been really lucky that I think, you know, based on the work that I kind of did for 5 years, my sales have keep coming in and I've been able to go this far. I mean, I would love it to be a full-time job one day. I couldn't think of anything better.
Mm.
But I definitely need to kind of, I can't keep on doing it all myself. I need to learn how to work with some people and to find that, because it's, as we kind of said before we started recording, like, there's so many false beginnings with photo books. You kind of start with the editing and you get to that point, and then there's the funding and then the printing, and then what I've found in my experience now is often, and this has been to my detriment, that I'll be working on maybe printing 2 or 3, 4 books at the same time because of shipping. I'd ship everything to Europe, so I need to ship it together. So by the time I've kind of got to the point where everything is printed, I'm just burnt out. And the release of the books never kind of has my full energy. So I need to kind of learn how to divide that up in a way.
Mm.
It's because there's no point doing all that work if then I'm releasing it and it's just kind of trickling out there. Like, but it's hard to kind of have enough energy for all the parts that are involved.
Yeah. But you sound like, because, you know, because you've never really had any expectation of earning money from actually shooting pictures, you know, which might be a kind of sign of the times in a way, because you're only 30 now. You're quite happy in a way for that to remain. I mean, obviously, in a perfect world, you know, be getting paid thousands of pounds to take, you know, whatever pictures you wanted to. But, you know, that's, we'd all like to be in that situation. But are you kind of have no expectations of any income from the photography?
From my own photography, not so much. I'm happy that I can do it, and that's kind of okay with me. I have much more higher expectations of the publishing. I mean, that needs to be financially viable. That needs to cover itself. Otherwise, it can't continue.
Mm.
And in some ways, maybe I care more. I know I can always find a way to kind of do my own projects, and you're right, kind of, I never had the expectation of earning money from it. It wasn't, I kind of just jumped into it without ever thinking.
Yeah.
And then you're kind of in it and you don't have time to get out, and it's just like, just kind of goes like that.
It's often the best way to do things.
Yeah.
Kind of ready, fire, aim.
Would have been great to kind of like, you know, talk to some people at the beginning, like, you know, and like, how does this work? How do you do it? Like, I kind of feel like that would have been very valuable, but it probably would have stopped me from ever.
Yeah, because then the danger is they say, look, don't even go there. It's really, you know, and then you might get put off.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's very true with the publishing. If I knew then what I know now, I wouldn't have gone this far.
Right, exactly. Sometimes it's better to live in blissful ignorance of the reality, and then suddenly things become possible that, you know, in theory aren't.
I mean, I hope
shouldn't
it can,
be possible.
I hope it can continue to grow. I mean, I just love the idea of it being a platform for photographers who kind of relate to this kind of subject, and that it can be, you know, known for this kind of work, and it can be a place where photographers feel they can submit this kind of work. And you know, after a few years, I started getting submissions, and it was kind of clear that people understood the philosophy, and that was really important to me. I was like, yes, okay, it's kind of, they're seeing it now as like they want their work here because of what I built, and that's kind of for me, that's kind of a real good sign of success.
Mm.
That's something I'm thankful for.
Well, good. Well, thanks for chatting. I think thanks so much for kind of sharing your, you know, as I say, hard-won wisdom, because I think it's really useful for people. And yeah, it's been great meeting you. Thanks, Aina.
Thank you very much.